members, as I indicated earlier, our HIV/AIDS budget is integrated within our child care and protection program, and that's why you're not going to see sort of a specific budget allocation here. But here again, we've, from the 18-19 adjusted budget, we've actually had 11.1%. In 2021, we'll be looking at a 7.8% increase, and in 21-22, it looks like a little bit of a 6.3% increase across the members. Program 3, Children and Families, I think in the light of the Western Cape and the context of the Western Cape, one of the most important programs that the department runs. And our aim here is to provide comprehensive child care, child and family care and support services to communities. Once again, we do this in consultation and in partnership with our stakeholders and civil society organizations. Within the program 3, Children and Families, we have five sub-programs. We have care and support services to families. So we're looking at implementing programs that promote functional families and try to prevent vulnerability in families. Our child care and protection services, we look at designing and implementing integrated programs. ECD, we are providing comprehensive early childhood development services. With our child and youth care centers, we provide alternative care and support to vulnerable children, and also with our community-based care services to children, we provide protection, care and support to vulnerable children within communities. Our focus for 2019-20 is that we have an adequate and even spread of essential community-based prevention and early intervention programs, family promotion and preservation services, therapeutic programs, and of course reintegration and mediation services. Also, we want to integrate and expand our Isibindi, Eye on the Child, and Drop-in Center programs. We also want to facilitate and support integrated service delivery, and that there's a basket of services available at community-based level. And we are going to provide targeted age-appropriate and early intervention services for vulnerable at-risk children. And this we're going to do within the integrated Isibindi program. Finally, one of our focus for 1920 is also the provision of safe shelters that offer programs aimed at rehabilitating, reunifying, and reintegrating homeless adults back into their families and communities of origin. Again, members, just some input on the performance of the department over the last 5 years. With respect to our child care and protection program, here we're looking at preventative services, early intervention, statutory services for children in need of care and protection, and the provision of aftercare services. So we've got the preventative services, which looks at parental responsibilities, public education, focusing on civic responsibilities, and of course there is an obligation to report child maltreatment, so as to prevent child abuse and neglect and exploitation. Then with our early intervention services, we provide a range of programs that include but aren't limited to adolescent development programs for children with behavioral problems, anti-bullying programs, trauma and bereavement support and counseling, support to unaccompanied and separated migrant children. And our statutory services, we do safety and risk assessment. We have temporary safe care for children at risk. Children in foster care is an also important part of our program, as well as adoption, and then also transitional care and support programs for children about to exit the alternative care. That's actually very important. Once the kids leave our system, that we provide support to them then as well. With respect to aftercare services, we're looking at reunification. We also there, through the application of norms and standards in terms of the Children's Act, so that we have continuous monitoring of the NGOs working within the childcare protection sector. We also have continuous training of social service practitioners, and also what we started last year was the implementation of the provincial and regional child death review panels, which we do in collaboration with the Department of Health, tertiary educational institutions, SAPS, and the Department of Justice. Once again, members, some performance information regarding our strategic objective achievement. Our ECD and partial care program, I think, is of great interest to many people, and our aim here is to facilitate and support the registration and re-registration of partial care facilities as well as ECD programs. So, care and members, it's not only facilities that we see whether they meet the norms and standards, but it's also the programs that are actually implemented in the centres as well need to be up to a particular standard. We also facilitate the registration of partial care facilities for children with disabilities, and that is in terms of the white paper on the rights of persons with disabilities is used as a guide here. And we're always looking at ongoing quality and improvement in partial care, and we do this in partnerships, as I said, with other departments and role players. We prioritize funding for children in the ECD partial care facilities, and those applying for the first time. We've got a conditional grant, which you also probably hear more about a little bit later. One thing that we have done here, members, for this financial year, the subsidy, the unit subsidy per child per day has been increased from 15 to 16 rand, and although it's way overdue, we've also prioritizing conditionally registered ECD facilities so that we can give them conditional registration, look at minor infrastructure upgrades, and also then maintenance of these facilities through the conditional grant. Further, priorities for the current year is to increase access to after-school care facilities. So not only does this program deal with ECD per se, but it also deals with the after-school care centers, and then also the programs run at these centers. We want to, and with the after-school care centers, we also increase the subsidy of the kids from 8 to 9 rand per child per day. And we actually fund, I forgot to mention it, that we fund for 265 days a year. So that's practically most of the year. I think there are instances where they're not funded for, I think in other provinces, they're funded for a little bit less days in the year. Our aim with respect to also our ECD is to try and improve the quality of the nutrition at these partial care sites, and we also run out of centre programs. And we are also looking at, well, we're quite busy with the development of an integrated provincial ECD strategy, which is of course aligned with the National Department's integrated ECD strategy. Again, members, some performance information in terms of how we've also been trying to get more and more children into quality ECD. Our child care and protection program. Our focus here would be to finalize the strategy for the provision of child and youth care centers in the Western Cape, so that there is over the continuum of care and protection for these children. So again, ensure registration of these CYCCs, or child and youth care centers, and to ensure that we sort of on top of the renewal of the child and youth care center registrations. We put in place a centralized management system, so that ensures that we place kids in the correct program in line with the Children's Act. We've also got a centralized register for all children in residential alternative care and their movement. And of course, we screen applications of children to move to a higher level of care so that they are, we ensure that they're placed in the best, least restrictive, and most empowering environment. There are various levels of care. Level 2, 3, and 4, as you can see there, deals with level 2 for children in need of care and protection. There we have the secure care in terms of the Children's Act for children with acute behavior and management needs. And level 4 is, of course, our secure care in terms of the Child Justice Act, and which we do have our holistic program for the kids at all levels. Okay, once again, well, some performance information members and chairperson. Okay, our sub-program, community-based care services for children. Our focus here is on an integrated ECPND program. What we want to do is to actually link together program, the Eye on the Child program, the programs that are running drop-in centers, so that we almost have a comprehensive safety net. And that also means that the expanded care for children within an area, so that we don't duplicate, that we actually build the strengths of each of these programs to have an integrated child protection program. So we will then strengthen our measures and we also have an expansion of the program. To this end, our focus is on the actual training. Sorry, I think I'm losing my place. So our focus here is actually on the training of child and youth care workers. And what we mean here is that we're not only training them as in the past where it was just, for example, only on the ECPND program. Now we are giving them accredited training that allows them to work across a host of other programs as registered and accredited child care workers. I've got some notes sometimes that I've made on the presentation. Yet again, with respect to the budget, we've actually had an 8.5% increase on our adjusted 18-19 budget to 19-20. Then from 19-20 to 2021, we're looking at around 5.6. And from 21 to 22, we're looking at approximately 4.5%. And you may wonder why there is no budget by the community-based services sub-program. It's because that budget has been integrated into the Children and Families program. And that's the budget that deals with the training of the child and youth care workers. Program 4. Restorative services. The purpose of this program is to provide integrated developmental social crime prevention and anti-substance abuse services to persons, most vulnerable persons. The sub-programs are social crime prevention and support, victim empowerment, and then substance abuse prevention and rehabilitation. crime support. We want to implement social crime prevention programs, and we provide probation services that target children, youth, and adult offenders as well. Our victim empowerment program is looking at integrated programs and services that will support and provide care and empower victims of violence and crime, and of course in particular women and children. And of course our substance abuse is to implement integrated services for substance abuse prevention, treatment and rehabilitation. The focus of our crime prevention program for this financial year, we will provide a range of specialized probation, case management interventions to persons in conflict with the law and of course their victims. We are going to implement a provincial diversion register, so that we can monitor, have more effective monitoring and analyzing and mapping of the flow of children through the criminal justice system. And we also provide residential secure care programs at government and outsourced child and youth care centers. And they of course focus on care and development and support for children and youth in conflict with the law. And the aim is to reduce recidivism, that is reoffending. We are also providing a range of integrative or integration interventions that are either community-based or residential. And we facilitate training workshops to build the capacity of probation practitioners. These are the staff who have the job of working with the children in the diversion program. We want to have a seamless diversion accreditation mechanism so that we can have more programs available and a bigger variety of programs available to young people to be diverted from the criminal justice system. Chair and members, some performance information with respect to how we are progressing towards our strategic plan target. Our next program, sub-program, is victim empowerment. And this is still within program 4, restorative services. Here we look at the funding of shelters and service organizations, and of course enhancing the quality of the services that are provided. We look at and facilitate community outreach activities and educational workshops in order to educate the community at large about gender-based violence and the services that are available to victims of crime. We facilitate the provision of accredited skills development programs for residents in the shelters, and we are also providing rehabilitation and prevention interventions for victims of human trafficking. We look at the accreditation also of shelters and service organizations that provide adult victims that provide for adult victims of trafficking services. We're looking at ensuring an effective referral system from our funded shelters to services provided by the Saudi Bartman Center. And we also ensure regular feedback on the referrals that we receive from the Gender-Based Violence Command Center. This is a 24-hour call center staffed by social workers which assist victims of gender-based violence, and they are it's an, our National Department of Social Development center, and they actually are available throughout. It's available. The services are available throughout the country. We are also looking at implementing a victim empowerment strategy and strengthening the aftercare services for sexual assault victims. Chair and members, we look at the performance information and we see that we are actually more and more people are requiring the services, requiring and accessing our victim support services. The last sub-program in program 4 is our substance abuse prevention and rehabilitation program. Here our focus is also on the registration of treatment facilities and therapeutic interventions so that we can ensure that they comply with minimum norms and standards. We also ensure compliance of health-related standards within our registered inpatient treatment centers. And we're also looking at capacity building and training additional social workers to be able to actually work within this as the substance abuse field through the implementation of post and undergraduate accredited courses. And we also want to expand on the capacity of our own services in the specialist fields of addiction care and community-based responses to substance abuse treatment. We also have a residential substance abuse program, which we will continue to provide the children, both boys and girls, between the ages of 13 and 15 at our Vindalani Child and Youth Care Center, and we've got one as well for boys aged 16 and 17 and adult males at our DeNova Substance Abuse Treatment Center. Substance abuse treatment programs have also been introduced in all our secure care facilities and as well as at 10 high-risk high schools in the Western Cape. We will also continue with our opiate substitution program in Mitchell Plain and Nova Park. Okay, here we can also have a look at the numbers of our service users that have been accessing the substance abuse services that we provide. Members, again, a little bit on the budget. We've seen a 7.7% increase from our adjusted 18-19 budget for this, the restorative services program, which will also be we'll have another 7.3% for the 2021. And then it will an increase of about 6.1% in 21-22. The final program, Chair and members, is the Program 5, Development and Research. The purpose of this Program 5 is to provide sustainable development programs that will facilitate community empowerment, and that these programs are based on empirical research and on demographic information. There are a number of sub-programs in Program 5, community mobilization, which we manage, the community mobilization interventions we manage actually transversely within all our sub-programs. We have institutional capacity building, where we provide support to NPOs to enable them to register, and also we provide them with capacity building and around how to manage NPO funding, and also just how to be, we work with them to actually create an environment within which NGOs can go out and actually partner with us and do work within the community. We also have a poverty alleviation and sustainable livelihoods program, which manages social facilitation and poverty with sustainable livelihood programs, and we include our expanded public works program here. There's a community-based research and planning sub-program, and this is also something that is managed transversely across the various sub-programs. Our youth development sub-program, which we the purpose of which is to create an environment to assist young people so they can develop constructive, affirmative and sustainable relationships, and also by also providing them with opportunities to build their own competencies and skills so that they can engage and be partners in their own development and that of their community. There is a women development sub-program that is also managed, in women development interventions are also managed transversely across all the sub-programs in the department. And finally, there is the population policy promotion sub-program. And we, through this, we actually hope to promote the use of information, especially demographic information and population research, to be used when planning programs and when planning interventions in communities. What we're going to be doing over the coming year, the institutional capacity building and support for NPOs programs will continue with the excellent work they're doing via the registration support services, through which they help various numbers of NGOs to actually be able to register. This also will continue with the NPO governance and functionality training, and also the mentoring of NPOs to enable them to get to a situation where they are able to provide services to the communities. We've also continue with the establishment of our NPO help desk and other networks to support NPOs at the local level, and we will continue to link NPOs with networking and training opportunities. And here again, we have some information in terms of the numbers of NGOs that we have, that we actually have been able to provide with capacity enhancements and support services. Program 5, our sub-program Sustainable Livelihoods and Poverty Alleviation. During the current financial year, we will continue with the provision of temporary work opportunities and income to unemployed persons. We also will continue with our targeted feeding program in conjunction with the Department of Health. And also, we are going to be looking at the implementation of the norms and standards for sustainable livelihoods programs. Currently as well, we have seen an increase in the number of individuals that we actually have now benefiting from our poverty alleviation initiatives. With respect to our youth development sub-program, our focus here, our key focus is actually on building based on holistic skills development for young people to make them more employable, positive, healthy, and well-prepared for adulthood. And the youth cafes that the department has funded and established is a key contributor with respect to this goal. We will also continue providing accessible services and opportunities, but we will also do all youth, but the focus will be on needs. Those youth not in employment, education, and training. And also they are youth in transition. We will also enhance the services to youth by offering life skills training, mentoring, coaching, leadership, entrepreneurship, and accredited formal training and job preparedness training. Our core focus will continue to be on the strengthening and expansion of the youth cafes. Currently, we have 11 established youth cafes and also the provision of community-based youth services that are aligned and support the existing and the, I think, extra two youth cafes, if I'm not mistaken, that we hope to establish within this current financial year. But, of course, there will be a high focus on our needs, our not in education and employment and training. And we will also provide after-school care programs to school-going youth through the Youth Cafe Network. Again, Chair and members, some performance information relating to the Youth Development Program. Our final sub-program, Chair and members, is our population policy promotion program. This program will focus on the promotion of population policy to all government planners in the province and as well as in the three spheres of government. And we will be looking at developing community profiles, and that will actually have an investigator identification of high risk factors and of access to community assets, so that we can use this to inform our community level child protection strategies. We will also here be updating our population projections for the province, disaggregated by gender and age. The last time we had real valid data was in 2016. So we're going to be using the valid data that we've got from since then to actually look at our population projections up until 2040. So the profiles, as I said, will focus on the community socioeconomic conditions in high crime areas so that we can be more effective in targeting and coordinating our services. And finally, with respect to the budget, it's quite interesting, this budget, in terms of that we have had, we've got added almost a 23% increase from our 18-19 budget. And that has been due to the money that we are going to be putting into EPWP and also our youth cafes and our youth at work program in the province. Thereafter, in 2021, our budget will have increased by about 5.5%, and 2021-22, we're looking at about a 6.2% increase. Finally, Chair, and we were also asked to look at legislation in the pipeline, and that's why also it was. I thought it would be prudent to bring along the handout that I brought this afternoon, because that gives us actually an excellent overview of the legislation that is being considered nationally, and also that applies specifically to the social development sector. With respect to the provincial legislation, we are looking at the Western Cape Laws Amendment Bill. And this is about repealing old legislation. For example, we are repealing sort of the Administration of the Aged Persons Act, with the exception of particular sections. The Act was assigned to the provinces in 1996, but because we have got now the Older Persons Act, it makes that act actually redundant. Also, we're repealing... we are wanting to repeal certain the National Welfare Act of 1987 as far as it is assigned to the provinces, because it has no practical value, because the creation of welfare boards, and they don't exist anymore, and also the registration and funding of welfare organizations is now covered for the most part by the NPO Act of 1997. There are also the excluded sections of the National Welfare Act has also been repealed by the 2001 Social Development Act. So that is why it's legislation that is not actually required anymore. It is redundant. Chairperson, members, that's my 1 hour work, sorry. I think we'll take questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Johnson. That was quite a comprehensive update. I think you're ready to run a marathon. Members, just before we proceed to questions, may I ask those colleagues that joined us later, they could just introduce themselves for the hands-on as well, just by switching on the microphone and just telling us who you are.
Good afternoon. I'm Evie Gauss from Drakenstein Municipality, and I'm the MMC for Social Services.
Good afternoon, Chair Member. I'm Ubi Makindi Samuel from PMG, Parliamentary Monitoring Group. Thank you very much. I remember Member Baku Baku Force had a question. Shall I start with you, ma'am?
Thank you. Sorry, I'm new. I'm not used. Thank you, Comrade Minister. Thank you, Minister. And Chair, you too, for the formal presentation. I'm really worried. When I was reading here, I saw that there is no budget for women. And we have high crime when it comes to women and children. I thought our focus would be straight in women and children, because in our province, there is a high number of women and children who are murdered. And the second question, if I may, I see that I hear that you are saying we will train social child youth care members this year, but I want to understand why they were not trained in the previous years, in 2017-2018. And the last from my side, if I'm right, the Department of Social Development is saying they are working together with the stakeholders in our communities. But I find it hard. I'm coming from the rural areas whereby we have a lot of children who are not going to the Christians because of the financial challenges. Their parents are not working, and they are the victims of rape because they are always in the streets and the sources or the criminals are taking advantage of that. And their mothers also, they are the victims because they are not working. Their boyfriends or their husbands are taking advantage of that. They become the victims of, let me put it this way, there is high rate of domestic violence in our area because women are not empowered, they are not working, they don't have daughters, or they are not privileged in this modern communications we are using. What is the MEC's plan when it comes to that, to reach in the deep rural areas? And the facilities, the last one is the facilities in our areas. We don't have facilities to run the programs. You will hear that this is, you will know that there is building that is not used. But when you go to the municipality will say it's under the Department of what. When you go that side, they are telling you to go that side, which is a little bit disturbing. And in our areas, we are working from the back of our yards, doing the exact job that social development is expecting us to do. But there is no resources. I want to make an example. There are children who are disabled. They have a coach in Kayamandi particular that I know because I'm residing in that area. that woman is working from her own house, whereas there are buildings that is not working in that area, is not used in that area. And I'm a little bit disturbed about that. There is a Kayamad Women and Children Development Project organization who worked with the women and children from 2007. I was privileged 2013 to be their chairperson. And the minister then, the MEC then, did visited the program that was led by the subs, and he promised to go back in that organization and see what they can do. Until today, they never went back. I'm still in contact with that organization, and as we speak, we hear that the municipality of Stellenbosch want to take over the building that they are using from 2007 because they want to make a taxi rank office, disadvantaging the women and the children who are getting services from that organization. And they are also providing CNTC, which is funded by the Department of Social Development. But they must move because the municipality wants to have the office for the tax rent, and that thing is disturbing. Thank you very much.
Do you want to answer those and then we'll take the next part?
Those were six questions. I just fear that if we were to take the full round, we might lose sight of where we're going. I think I can identify with what it is you're saying. Having traveled as far as Maritzburg and actually seeing what happens in the deep rural areas and services and how we get them there. But the challenge outside of the metro, we obviously have 29 other municipalities, and we need to, I hear what you say about the minister, I'm starting with the end question. The minister was there in 2013 and no one has come back. So I am going to ask you to forward me the details for that facility so I can, as I crisscross the province, to go and inspect sites and facilities, I can go and see for myself what is happening. But we also need to use the local structures that are available in that municipality. Is there a ward committee that is set up? Because your ward committee would normally have health, religious, you know, all the sport, everybody represented. And how does that unfold itself? But if it's flagged, I can take it to the meetings of the mayors where we tell them these are concerns that we have picked up that you would need to act on. So the Kayamandi crash for this disabled, I have here. I don't know what arrangement the municipality has made with the taxi owners in terms of an office. But we must always place our children, especially disabled children, at the top of the priority list. So that does require a conversation to be had. Coming back to the no budget for women, Robert, maybe you can talk to Willie and how we deal with the no budget for women, please.
The budget item for women's projects is quite a new item that was introduced into the budget program structure of social development by the national department. I think it's only been there for 3 years or something, like that, yeah. We've never been in a position to actually put any funds directly into it because we've had no additional funds for that program. So it's a category of financial category, but it doesn't mean to say that we don't have any projects that benefit women. The entire victim empowerment program is almost entirely focused on assisting women who are victims of domestic violence and so on. And that budget has grown enormously, so we wouldn't put money that is needed for shelters for women and other trauma services and so on. We wouldn't put that into the budget for women, the budget for women, because that money goes into the victim empowerment budget already. Then we would be causing trouble for ourselves in terms of accounting, because we would have to account across two different categories. Also, there's a lot of funding that goes into women's empowerment in the poverty program in the departments, there's a whole range of things. So it's spread across the programs, and I think that we could put specific money into the item that's earmarked or marked in the budget structure as being for women, but it would still be used for the same thing we're using it at the moment. It hasn't made sense in that respect. I think some of the provinces have gone on a specific set of projects around funding women's co-ops, and they've used that budget item for that. We've never been in a position to be able to go down that road because we do not have enough money. Unfortunately, our legal mandates, the services that we must render in law, have dominated our budgets, and that includes things like shelters for women.
I think there's another aspect we must consider, is that the departments in the province don't necessarily mirror the departments at national. At national, we have a department for women, children, and people with disabilities. We just have the Department of Social Development, so we need to create that synergies now between the National Department of Social Development. And obviously, when I get invited to the first MINRI, which is where all our provincial MECs get together, we'll have to find out how we can piggyback off the Department of Women, which is set aside from our DSP, as if it were. At the end of the day, women enjoy the bulk of the budget, but under sad circumstances. And it's difficult to say you empower a woman when you find a situation where at a police station, and I think of Beaufort West, you've got the perpetrator at the desk there, and you've got the woman who's the victim sitting in the room next door where everyone can see the victim. So those are the kinds of things that we would probably need to, where we can make the quick fixes together with other stakeholders. Remember that we don't work in isolation. We rely heavily on NGOs and NPOs to alert us to situations, especially in the rural areas. But I will definitely, Ms. Bakubaku, follow up on the Kayamandi example that you've given, and if, as I said, if you could forward the detail to me. In fact, we could go out there together and you could show me what it's all about, and then I can say I've seen it firsthand. Yes. I think I've covered most everything. The training of child youth care workers.
The training of child and youth care workers, the question was why it hadn't been done in previous years. The training of child and youth care workers was a specific project that we did because of a new registration requirement that was introduced for child and youth care workers. So there has been training in prior years in relation to the procedures they need to follow in the facilities that they service, which is the secure care facilities that we run as a department. But for this particular project, it was a group training. It was a group training for. So it's a Bindi. I think you knew what it is. It's a Bindi, which is this community-based one. Yeah. But we have had to do a training for our child and youth care workers to get them registered, because it's a new requirement that came in, when was it, 2 years ago, approximately, that by law now child and youth care workers must be registered. That didn't used to be a requirement. So we've had to train up our child and youth care workers. But you were saying about the CBD, do you have an additional reason?
If you don't mind, Honourable Member, it was also with the Zibindi program, the National Association of Child and Youth Care Workers, the NACCW, they used to fund the Zibindi project, the training in the Western Cape province, and they were funded by National DSD. Then that project ended here by March 2018, and we had to take over. So in the process of taking over, we could not do training until we got training done by Huguenot College in Wellington. So that's why in this year you will find again 20 people. So we started the process by taking over from NACCW. Okay.
Members, are there any other members with questions? Member Philando and then Barnes.
Thank you, Chairperson. In terms of social welfare services, when we say about the care and the service to older persons, and we say we anticipate the whole of society approach and integrated services towards, I'm curious to know whether this include human settlements as well, that residential facilities for older people as well. Because many a times you find older people living on the third floor of flats, and they are basically cut off from the rest of the world. How do you work? Do you work with councils? I know there's certain councils that have policies that makes provision for older people, for people with disabilities, that they are able to move out of flats and so forth into formal houses. But is there any correlation between this department and human settlements where something like this is reported and the department can do an assessment and then it is dealt with accordingly? Also, people with disabilities, if we anticipate a job in every home, many times those are the groups, the vulnerable groups that are left out when it comes to job seeking or job opportunities. How do we include them also from the department side? In, for instance, EPWP projects, job opportunities within councils and so forth. What is that correlation as well? And then in terms of older persons and frail care facilities, I know, for instance, in Paul there's a rest of old age home, which has many challenges in terms of the crime and the drug problem around surrounding. But they also have a lot of frail care patients there as well. And then there's a clinic, for instance, the JJ, the pre-clinic that closed down. So that facility is only standing there. So how does the department then speak to public works, speak to health services to make sure that that facility can be used for that purpose? And then on social relief, the focus on that, donation management, and I think it's very important once you work on the ground, you work within your constituency, that you have the tools and the means to explain to our people as to exactly how this works and how this is managed. So what exactly does this form of relief entail, especially in the Cape Winelands humanitarian relief stream? How is it managed there? And also I've visited the creche in Bakweni, which is I assume it's a subsidy that was stopped. So what the principal told me, once there was an inspection, they didn't receive money anymore. But we must also know that certain areas are more affluent than others, and there are some creches or ECD centers that we need to take by the hand and say, listen, this is what we find fault with the establishment, and this is how we as a department can assist you in order to gain that funding again. So what is the operation in terms of that? And then also community-based care services for children. How does the identification of that work in the different regions? And then my last question, the high-risk schools, I think 10 was mentioned. How is that program for abuse treatment programs currently run in that school? And perhaps we can just say how many schools are in the metro, in the rural areas, and so forth. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Minister, if we could answer those, and then we'll go to Member Barnes, because I counted 7 questions.
I'd like to ask the role of Dr. McDonald to respond. Maybe we'll post everything and then tell us if you can.
Thanks, Chair. Yeah, the Older Persons Program, do we work with human settlements and local governments around helping older persons access housing? Yes. We are currently working on a special needs housing policy with the Department of Human Settlements. This is something which we'd hoped would be forthcoming at the national level. They are working on something at the national level, but it seems to be not getting finished. So the previous MECs for the respective departments agreed that they would go forward with developing a provincial special needs housing policy. which will help guide the prioritization of people with special needs, which is disabled persons, older persons. Having said that, we do already prioritize. There's a long list of people who received houses because we as DST have referred them to them in the Settlements Department and asked them to prioritize. So we do have a good working relationship in that respect, but it needs to be formalized.
If I may just, and I'm sorry, I'm going to ask you to pause there, HOD. Last week we visited Mufuleni, and I actually took pictures of a home for display disabled person with the ramp, the bathroom all kitted out with the necessary, it's amazing. It's incredible, and it's all on ground level to make provision for the older, the senior citizen and the disabled to live in a block in an integrated settlement. So it's actually happening, and it's out there.
The next question is related to how we help disabled persons to avoid the situation where they're excluded from potential job opportunities. Perhaps Mr. Jordan would like to just say something about the protective workshops and how they link to skills and job opportunities.
Honourable Member, we've got about 54 protective workshops throughout the province, which is funded by our disability program. So it is in rural areas. We've got one in Beaufort West, for example, also that's what we've got on West Coast. We've got quite a few places. The protective workshop's main aim is to do protective job creation for people with disabilities. So it could be physically disabled people, it could even be intellectually disabled people. So for example, just go to a visitor area, we'll find the weeding of baskets and stuff, which is part of those kind of projects. Depending on the care level of a disabled person, some people unfortunately will never be able to go into the open job market because of the intellectual disability. So that's where they then will do the work, they will get food, we actually provide them psychological social support into that protective workshops. We support their families if need to do follow-ups and stuff. We even got Cape Mental Health, that's got their own protective workshops also. So there's quite a few things we do when it comes to the creation of disability in the protective workshops. There's also in the EPW program, there is some of our disabled people that's linked into those programs. So we try to mainstream disability as far as possible. We've got a mainstreaming policy that we've developed as a department on mainstreaming disability, mainstreaming it into the programs. We're actually now in the process of starting to register also ECDs exclusively for disabled children. We've got a cluster of disabled children specifically, but where we can mainstream them also in a mainstream ECD, we do that as well. So we follow all of those kinds of things. To be very honest, we still have to increase the footprint in mainstream ECDs, because going with that, usually you would need a additional carer that's got a speciality training to support that child in a mainstream ECD. We have embarked on a process, so yeah, it's all part of our plans.
Thanks, Charles. Just to add, look, as a general principle, our department doesn't have an adequate footprint on almost any level. I think the only area where I would say that we are providing a reasonably adequate coverage of services for people is where we have a legal obligation to act, which is around child protection. That is the only area where I'd say that we are more or less covering what we should be covering across the entire province. In almost every other area of service delivery, we are not meeting the need, and that is simply because there is not enough money. And we have been informed by the National Treasury that we can expect further cuts. They're asking us as a province to look at 5% cuts on our projected baseline for the coming years, 6% on the outer year, 7% on the outer year for every department in the province and across the whole country. And a lot of that will be to do with under-collection of tax at SARS together with the 230 million rand that they need for ESCOP. So all that money is going to come out of our budgets. So our services are not going to expand over the next 3 years, they're going to get smaller, which means that obviously there's going to be even bigger gaps in our coverage of services where we need it. And disabilities is an area where we've got a particularly severe backlog of services compared to the demand. Disability is grossly under catered for by governments in South Africa generally. And we've been trying very hard to increase our budgets over the last 10, 15 years to actually catch up with this, and we're making some headway, but we're still a long way off. So that's why we have things like court cases ordering the state to do more, because there's massive gaps. And it's not only here. The court case, in fact, that was referred to earlier by Marion Johnson was a case that was primarily directed at the education department, because the education system was failing to cater for children with intellectual disability. But alongside that, we are failing to cater for children with intellectual disabilities in terms of residential care. We don't have enough residential care for these children. There's many children who are languishing in unfunded, unregistered residential facilities where they are in sometimes very serious danger. We had closures of some of these centres in the past year by the fire departments because of exposed electrical equipment and other things where the children are exposed to the risk of fire and so forth. So it's a very bad situation on the ground. And obviously we deal with the most severe cases as far as we possibly can, but the system is totally overstretched. So I think that we must emphasize that what you will find over the next 5 years is that there are going to be gaps all over the place, and we try as far as we can to mitigate the risk associated with those gaps. And by and large, the teams do quite a good job in that respect, and the NGO sector is spectacular in coming to the party most times. But we do have to be very upfront about that. This is a department that's a work in progress, I think would be the best description. Bearing in mind also that we have the projection of an increase in our population in the province of about 700,000 in the next 5 years, so it's about approximately 10%, 12% growth in population we're expecting in this province in 5 years. I think the bulk of which is still actually from people reproducing in this province, and then there's a large component of people coming into the province who are obviously looking for economic opportunities from other provinces where the economy is performing less well. So there is an in-migration, but there is also a growth in the population itself where people are giving bigger families. People are also living longer, which also increases the population. We're expecting an expansion of pressure on older persons' facilities in the next 5 to 10 years because more and more people are reaching elderly age because of increased longevity. So the life expectation in this province is higher than just about any other province. It's probably similar to Gauteng, but even slightly higher than Gauteng, if I'm not mistaken. But that does cost extra money because people live longer, you have more people. So I think that we just need to contextualise that. The question of the frail care facilities in Rostov, if perhaps the honourable member could give us the information on that particular facility, then we can try and assist with it. But obviously we need the specifics so we can follow up. The use of facilities is a challenging thing as well, I should stress. Each department in the province has to get its facilities from the public works department. So no department has its own facilities in this government. All departments use public works property, and there's some legislation around that and how we use it, the Guyana Act among others. The municipalities have their properties, and sometimes we get lucky and municipalities make space available to us, but it's not often the case. Unfortunately, municipalities often have their own needs for those facilities, or the facilities are just totally unsuitable and can't actually be used. Because as soon as we take up a facility or one of the NGOs does, it has to meet occupational health and safety standards. If it doesn't, then they can't really be used. So it depends on the quality of what they have. I think the question of social relief in the Wynelands area particularly, but across the board, we are part of the disaster management sector in the province. Our social relief and distress team is primarily concerned with coordinating the social workers doing assessments of victims of disasters, and those assessments are used to provide SASA with information so that they can provide social relief packages. Before the post office took over the grant payments, SASA used to have an arrangement with CPS that they paid something called the Social Relief and Distress Grant, which was a 3 month grant for people who were in dire need of money. Ever since they moved over to the post office, they didn't move over the function of the payment of social relief grants. So what they do now is they provide only food parcels or grocery parcels. So what we do is we do an assessment of a family affected by disaster. We give it to SASA, and then SASA will, if they agree with the assessment and that it shows that people need it, they will give them 3 months worth of grocery hampers to help them. The municipalities have a role as well. The municipalities provide, if there's been a fire, they usually provide basic building material if it's in the metro. Outside the metro, many of the municipalities are struggling. They don't have that sort of capacity. And that's where we're running into difficulties. The Provincial Disaster Management Centre also tries to assist to some extent. That falls under the Department of Local Government. But generally, we also have to play a bigger role in the rural areas where the municipalities aren't so strong. In the city centre, the metro actually has a proper disaster management unit with quite good resources, and they provide building kits and blankets and everything else. The question of the creche in Mekweni, again, if we could get that specific name of the creche and the details, we could look into it. But as a general principle, we only stop funding organisations as a last resort. So if organisations default on sending us, for example, their quarterly reports, or if they don't send us their audited financial statements, which they're required to do yearly in terms of the contracts that they sign with government, we will first intervene with them, talk to them, try and get them to get a right system where we can. We usually give them extensions, sometimes up to a year. But after we've done all of that and they're still not paying for the party, we have to stop funding them, because otherwise we will be found wanting by the Auditor General and by this committee as well for not managing public funds. So there's always a kind of process. We never stop funding an organisation without first engaging them and trying to get them to work and get their stuff right. And look, it is a big problem, particularly with ECDs. They often don't have much administrative capacity, and they battle. We try to make things as streamlined as we can, but we still have basic requirements that they must comply with so that we know what they've used the money for. Because sometimes these places, they go and they draw money and they use it for something else. And that's why we get audited financial statements. So we see if they've done any cash withdrawals that they can't account for, then obviously there's a possibility that money has been stolen. And we do have cases like that from time to time. So we have to be quite strict. And a lot of the systems we put in place were after having audit findings over the years of not ensuring money's used for its intended purpose. So we've tightened things up to the extent that the AG is now satisfied, but it does make things harder on the NGOs. Community-based care services for children and how we choose to identify areas. We focus the SFND program in areas where obviously there's a high risk of crime and violence affecting children, and also where we've seen the possibility to create synergies with other projects at the local level. So we're trying to connect the SFND program with the drop-in centres that we run, where we can refer children for more intensive services where we need them. But we've targeted areas where we've picked up high rates of school dropout, high rates of children at risk of being victims themselves, or children who are engaging in risky behaviour. Those are the kind of criteria we look at. We also have to look at whether there are suitable organisations to actually implement programs. There are some areas where we really struggle to find organisations that can actually do this kind of work, so it's very important consideration when we choose areas. If you want data on where we run these projects, we can give it, but we need a written request so we can go back and gather the information for you. And then the 10 high-risk schools where we operate, I'll give you the ones that I have in front of me. We've got the projects running in Elsie's River, Kraaifontein, Aitse, Hanover Park, Delft, Lenneburg, Kali, Circles, Younger, Crossroads, Durmstown, and Flutiesville and Stellenbosch. So those programs that we operate in the schools, we have a drug treatment professional who is actually stationed at the school, and they usually service that school and some up to two or three schools in the surrounding area. It's a very nice project because it also means that the drug treatment professionals develop a relationship with the school, the principals and the teachers, and help give them useful guidance in terms of how they can address children who have problems with risk behaviour. It seems to work well also that the children can go back to the counsellors if they need assistance. Because counselors are a permanent fixture in the school, but it seems to be a good model. So yeah, I think that covers it. In terms of rural urban, primarily it's been urban, because again it's down to the availability of organizations that are capable of running it, and primarily those have been in the city, and also we've targeted areas where we've got a serious problem with drug prevalence. So the areas where it's most severe, we've targeted those areas first.
Thank you, Jane. I'm going to disappoint you. Just two questions. My question is specifically on Program 3, the ECPD program. I have so much interest in that one because, according to the presentation, it says that the program will be expanded to Cape Winelands, Metro, etc. However, from where I'm sitting, I've seen in the Karoo, specifically in Maritzburg, that program has closed down. Does it mean that it's being parked, or is the new arrangement that you rather start at the Cape Metro Winelands? I need clarity on that because for where I'm standing, ECPD is no more in the Karoo. My second question then, however, goes to the youth cafes. How many youth cafes have been rolled out in the rural areas?
Can we also take Vinfo's question, if it's still there?
Yeah.
Mike, remember?
Sorry. It was also in the youth cafe, but I'm covered by my colleague or my... Yeah. Next to me. Then the second one is, as you remember, the department has been tasked by the Western Cape Cabinet to draft a plan of action to reduce child murder. So my question to the MEC is, how far are you with that and the implementation of that plan?
Last one, you're probably aware that there was a summit this weekend in Paul where the commitments were made to work transversely across departments to try and come with an integrated plan that deals with the issues of murder, not just in the red zones, but across the province. So we are going to set up I am literally an inter-ministerial task team that will actually deal with the issue. So it's not going to be located solely with the Department of Community Safety as oversight, but it will be transversal, and we will all then need to provide inputs to that. The two issues I just need to put on the table, the one is the methodology is always developmental. I just want to come back to the story of the creches and the fact they will only get shut down as a last resort if we believe that children's lives are threatened. So the idea is to try and encourage as many facilities to get registered. But we have 30 municipalities, including the metro, with 30 different bylaws. It depends on which area it is in. So that is one of the challenges. And then obviously the murder rate we've seen with the army moving in, so we've got them securing the situation. Now we need to have the plan. How do we reduce the number of, and I think this weekend was another horrific number of 43 people who were killed, and I think the last weekend we saw what happened in Delft. But the focus has to be on children and women. But I can't sit here and tell you I have a plan today, because we are now working on that plan to bring something to life together with external and civic, external stakeholders and civil society. You might be aware all the CPFs were involved. There are a lot of stakeholders across the spread, and I think it's important if you want to bring a solution to any community, you need to involve the community in finding that solution, because they then take ownership of any project rather than to just impose a project on a community and then they'll just say, ach, hulle dink was nodig die, was nodig regtig dat. So I think it's going to be a consultative process where all the voices in the room need to be heard, because otherwise we're constantly going to see the issue of areas that have been neglected. But it is on the radar and it is a priority, because all eyes are on
the Western Cape, especially with the crime that is spiraling out of control. Just for context there.
Yeah, thanks, Minister. I think that is the context. The plan of action for to reduce child murders was developed by a team which I chaired. The plan of action was finalized, brought to Cabinet. Cabinet adopted the plan as it stood. The plan was then workshopped with the Prop Joints Murders Priority Committee, we did receive some inputs from some of the other criminal justice stakeholders. It's also been consulted with civil society organizations as well as various departments and the municipalities. So there's a draft plan that has been consulted that we are now implementing. The plan can be made available to this committee, it's no problem. It's quite an extensive document. A lot of it overlaps with other projects and plans as well, because obviously it's not going to talk to a whole lot of new things when there's a lot of things we're already doing. It's more about coordination. So that project is underway. I think that the way it originated was we had a big spike in child murders, but what you've seen now is that obviously that's riding on the wave of violence and crime in this province. The big concern was specifically about children that were rendered vulnerable in their homes, where often someone known to them would abuse them and murder them. The vast majority of child murder statistics in this province are accounted for by gang violence. So getting the gang violence under control is going to be the single biggest lever in bringing down the number of child murders. Children are actively participating in the gangs from very early ages, even before their teens. Those children are getting killed frequently. That is a big factor that emerged in the research that went into that strategy. But we would be most happy to share the strategy with the standing committee. Any inputs will also be welcome from this committee. It's new eyes that could look at it as well. And it is a living document. We don't regard it as something that's finished and that will not change. So we have to keep on adapting it as time goes on. I think on the other two matters, the closure of Isipindi in Murraysburg, I believe, is due to the closure of the withdrawal of the annex organization, which so it wasn't a decision of the department to withdraw. It was, unfortunately, the NGO shut down and we didn't have another one to replace that project then. I don't know if you want to comment further on that.
No, actually, but we will look in the whole process because that is a big gap in Murraysburg. Bafford with Murraysburg is a serious concern to us. So we have raised with the minister, so we are looking at any other possibilities how we can deal with this matter. Because we need to have a facility for those children.
Just ask Ms. Van Staden to just tell you the sites where the youth cafes are.
We have seven youth cafes in the rural areas: George, Ulsborough, Groot Park, Rivier, Beleerstorp, Veldrup, Saldanha Bay, Fridazo. There are four in the metro, Vryfront, Mitchell's Plain, Crossroads and the Younger, and two in the planning stage. So by the end of this year, there will be 30. So seven in the rural, four in the metro. I would encourage members to visit a youth cafe. It is a great innovation. It's what they call youth funky. Youth are attracted to it, and that's what we want. We want youth to come to a program and then to look at needs holistically. One that we take a lot of people to is in Vryfront, you know, the situation in Vryfront. It's in partnership with NGOs, so the youth cafes are in partnership with NGOs that we vet, that carry our brand and carry the youth brand and the youth model. Every youth cafe is different in its, not in its target, but in its innovation. So some youth cafes is innovative in film making, some are innovative in technology, social media, in the green economy, but all of them are youth-friendly, one-stop shops in the middle of communities. And the vision is that, as a youth strategy says, by age 25, youth know, where am I going? And so the youth centers and youth cafes are those kind of programs where youth can come identify, where am I, what do I need, and that things are provided there, both hard and soft. Networking opportunities, and of course the biggest one is exit. When you leave a program, where do you go? And that's what we're hard on. You must have a plan, there must be support, there must be the next person, the next mentor. And that's the youth cafe.
Mentor Philander, do you have a follow-up?
Yes, Chairperson, just a matter of interest. The two in the planning phase, where will they be located?
I stand under correction, member. I do not have that information right now. Madam, would you have that? So I don't have that now, but could we provide it to you?
Yes, thank you.
Just a follow-up.
Don't please follow them. I cannot promise.
Follow-up from Member Buck.
Thank you.
I understand the first bit of budget and that's a harsh reality that I'm still absorbing here because it's just been into the
My follow-up question is that can Dr. McDonald, can you please provide us with the name of those schools? You mentioned three schools that you are working with. Can you please provide us with the names of the schools? And this is also the follow-up question. Minister, you mentioned in your presentation that you are funding NPOs that is complying. But I want to ask if do you do the follow-ups or do you monitor those NPOs, and how do you do your monitoring? Are you giving them funds and depend on their reports, or you are doing site visits? And I want to know if you are visiting the structure before you give them the funding. That's my two follow-up questions.
Honourable Member, thank you very much for that question on the monitoring. When we get every 3 years, we do a call for proposals where NGOs have applied for funding. If it's a new NGO that we've never funded before, the requirement is that we must go do a site visit. So we go out, so we've got monitoring and evaluation officials and social workers, so they go out for a site visit, they look at the finance, the governance. If it's an ECD or a children's fund, they will look at the norms and standards as per the Children's Act to see if they comply. Then they will come back and then we will make a decision to fund them if they comply with everything. I must, however, admit to you that about 4 or 5 years ago, those site visits were not done in the ECD sector, but I've introduced that they must go first to an ECD to do a site visit before we give any funding, because that was a problem 4 or 5 years ago. So we sat with a few NGOs or ECDs that should not have received funding. If we do monitoring, we've got a team. We do various kinds of monitoring. We do monitoring a desktop one, where we look where they need to give the quarterly reports when we fund them. We analyze the reports. We analyze the audit financial statements to see at the financial cash flow issues. We also look at norms and standards, and then we go and do a site visit if we do norms and standards. But unfortunately, we cannot go every month to these NGOs. We've got 2,300 NGOs, and we go through a full on-site visit every 1 to 3 years. Depends on if we've got red flag ones, and we've got immediately the red flag, then we go immediately. So we do also rapid assessments, where if you inform me of something like tomorrow morning, there will be a team to look at that. So we do then a visit for that too. Then we've also got quality assurance monitoring. That's another form of monitoring the evaluation. That is a more intense process. It's a 5-day site visit. So on day one, the NGO must fill in the form themselves, to rate themselves out of 100%, and then we go and rate them again from our side, and there where there's differences, then we start discussing it. If there's red flags in the NGO, we do not close them.
We do keep on following up. We develop a plan for them, and in that plan, we have 3 to 6 months, where we say, okay, you don't have a policy on quotes, for example. You need to have that policy in place. We will then follow up in 3 months to see if they've done it. Even if there is something that's happened wrong, we will keep on following up, even on the finance issues and the governance issues. Where we are, however, very strict. The moment we discover an NGO committing fraud or corruption with government funding or taxpayers' money, we take it out completely. We go full blast in with big teams. We analyze the finances. We get the proof. We can hand it over to the forensic unit. We do hand it over to SAPS police. We actually report cases. We reported a few years ago quite a few cases. So there we don't. Just take it very lightly if we discover somebody's doing fraud.
Thank you very much. Just in closing, just a few questions from my side. I just wanted to find out, just in terms of the percentage of HR support that comes from the corporate services center, is that all of the department's HR support, or is it just a small percentage? And then the sort of other questions relate to the DSD organizational structure and redesign. So what does that entail? And also sort of how is that going to play out with the sort of redesign of the government as a whole in terms of the department? And then in terms of providing a basket of services at community level, to what extent are you linked with the basket of services that are provided at municipalities? And then what type of data is being used at municipalities to make sure that those services are integrated? So is there a space that someone can go and they can check what services are offered where? The same with regards to the population policy promotion. Is it linked to the GCIS data that municipalities gather, specifically around the municipal facilities that are available? And then my last question, the plan to align with the National Integrated ECD Policy of 2015, what updates are forthcoming from either the Presidency, the National Ministry of Social Development, or the Ministry of Basic Education, with the announcement that the President made in the State of the Nation around the new future of ECDs? Do we know what that means for planning at provincial DSD level here?
Yeah, well, I'll start with that one since you mentioned it. The National Minister doesn't seem that clear on what the exact plan is. There was this talk of the grade before grade R going over. So the idea is that there's 2 compulsory years of education prior to grade 1. Grade R is not universally rolled out yet in this or any other province, so the idea of compulsory grade R seems a little far off at this point, and grade RR even more so. So not sure about how or when it could become compulsory, but even before we get to that point, there would have to be an institutional move which would require a legislative amendment to the Children's Act, because the Children's Act as it stands at the moment stipulates in there that ECD's responsibility of the MEC for social development. Unless the MEC for Social Development becomes the MEC of Education as well, which is technically possible, then you could easily do it, I suppose, but there's still the HOD question as well. So it's a bit sticky, and it would really require legislative amendments, not only to the Children's Act, but also to the Schools Act. We're not clear yet on whether ECDs at grade R or level would then become part of the SA schools in the Schools Act. The implications are quite far-reaching, obviously, because currently all of the grade RR, which isn't called grade RR officially yet, but currently all of those services are rendered by NGOs funded by the Department of Social Development, some of them are not funded. But if they became schools, they would have to change from being NGOs to being schools with governing bodies. That's quite a big thing. The other issue as well is that obviously the ECD teachers, as the grade R teachers are currently pushing with their sub 2, is pushing to get grade R teachers recognized as teachers on the same level as grade 1 and upper teachers. Obviously there's quite a significant salary implication. They would be paid a lot more. And then if they did the same with the grade R teachers as well, the salary implications would be even bigger. There's certainly no room in the fiscus to do that at this point in time. So I don't really know there's neither legislative nor financial means to put in place what has been suggested at the state. So there is a team that's been put together at ministerial national level to try and facilitate the beginning of the move of that extra year of grade RR from social development to education, but it can't actually move without some kind of legislative enablement, which is not on the list of the planned legislation that we've submitted to you from the national department at this stage. So I'm a little bit in the dark about it. It seems that no one is sure yet, but that's the plan, at least in the longish term. The other question about the basket of services available at community level, there is the linkage with GCIS data. Marion Johnson might tell you a bit about how we use that data, but we do participate in many of the TISOL centres, and we're always in the IDP sessions with the municipalities, especially in the rural areas. In fact, in the rural areas, we've got a very good gelled relationship with local government, as well as our counterparts and other departments at a local level. But maybe, Marion, you could just speak to the GCIS question.
Yes, in terms of information, especially demographic information, our research component was very closely with all municipalities. There's also been training of municipal officials in using demographic data. And we do, every year we do at least 6 community profiles. Most of them are at the district, municipal district level, where we also provide, and that information is made available to all municipalities for use in planning. Involved with the meadow as well, in providing population information. I'm just trying to... we've also finished a number of fact sheets, Minister, we must all give to you, which also looks at various demographic information, age, gender, sex, income, that also can be made available to the members, and that the municipalities also use in terms of their planning.
Yeah, this info also informs the growth potential of town study, which is used by the Department of Local Government and our planning department. So we align with that information as well, where we look for growing demand for services and target areas where we can predict that there's growing demand. So we align as far as we can. Obviously the municipal space is very fluid. A lot of the municipalities keep changing hands, which has made things a little bit more complicated, but there is stability lower down the ranks in terms of relationships. A lot of the municipalities also aren't heavily involved in the social development space, except for their involvement in registration of ECD facilities. The Children's Act does make municipalities responsible for that, and a lot of the rural ones have taken on that task with enthusiasm. But where we have like a really established social development unit is the City of Cape Town. They've actually got a department for social development. They do quite a lot of outreach work with street people, with registration of ECDs, and also with substance abuse and family strengthening programs. So they've got their own cadre of social workers in the city of Cape Town. The question about our organizational structure and redesign, there's at any given time there's always organizational design processes happening. In fact, it's a public service requirement that departments organizational design is reviewed, every 5 years we're supposed to review our structure to see if it's still relevant to our state. But our Chief Directorate for Welfare Services has become too big, and we've had a structural process to split it into, because it's just become overwhelming in size. The other major OD process we've got underway is to relook at capacity in our regions. We need to keep pace with population shifts in terms of keeping the number of social workers to population at a reasonable ratio. We are dropping behind the ratio of social workers to population. It should be 4,500 social workers, population to one social worker. That's the norm. We're a bit behind now, we're about 4,600, 4,700. We obviously try, we make that number up combined of our social workers as well as NGO funded social workers as well. So those two. The other organizational design process, which is probably the most pressing one for us, is that the SASA has been liquidated. They run two centers for us, St. William and Horizon, Child and Youth Care Centers, Secure Care Centers, that cater for children in conflict with the law. Those centers are contracted out, and the contract expires at the end of May 2020. We need to take over those services because FASAS has been liquidated. They're not going to be able to carry on rendering the service. In fact, it's not FASAS rendering the service anymore, it's the liquidators rendering the service. And when the contract expires, we are going to have to take over with staff of our own. So we've expanded our structure to include posts to enable us to run those centres ourselves. We're not looking to outsource it again, because last time we tendered, there were not any viable tenderers besides Vasasa that had nearly the ability or the capacity to actually run the service. So we don't believe that the private sector has the appetite or the capacity to take on this work. The NGOs certainly don't. And all other provinces in the country have taken a principled decision not to outsource any longer because of pressure from the unions that's going to kill any markets for this kind of service. So we can't expect the private sector to be interested in just one province. And then there was one further question, I think it was related to CNC. On the GM, was it?
What was that? The
corporate services
centers.
As a percentage, it's a bit hard maybe to give a percentage, but maybe Ms. Van Rielen can just speak to what they do and what we do.
Maybe just the main coordination of the HR fund system, I think we report with the partial custodians. So they process all the transactions on partial because we don't have access to partial transactions. Then they also put the templates together for HR plans and those things. And then they also manage the employee health and wellness program. And obviously we provide inputs to that. OD's exercises, they do all of those. They the whole system also. And then organizational behavior exercises, they also do for us based on our needs. Then the HRD functions, we do have a professional development component that is doing everything. They're just putting it in the templates on the other side, also around the groceries. They just process the payments, but the budget is in the departments. So that's more or less, it's very difficult to say percentage, but the easiest way is to say we're coordinating everything, and they're sitting with the system and putting it in the system.
If I may, the only two departments that don't fit in with CDC is health and education, purely based on the numbers, so they do their own. But the list of us all have to report into the centralized unit, yes. So there is a bit of a dependence on lags and leads and how we fill the posts. It would be good if we could get an improved turnaround, especially when it comes to social workers. But as I'm going around the province talking to our various service delivery areas, they actually relating instances of how long they've had to wait and what the turnaround time is. So that will be a focus area going forward, yes.
Thank you very much, Minister, and your team. This has been a very comprehensive introduction. I'm certainly filled with a lot of answers, but also a lot of questions. And I think our next engagements are going to be slightly longer, by judging by things. I think now, just to say thank you to you for coming. Please do feel free to have some refreshments. And then, members of the committee, if we can take a 10-minute comfort break. It's now 7 minutes past. We'll be back here by 20 past.
Thank you very much.
All right. This is the
It's
N-J-A-M-C-E.
Okay.
Thank you. Then drop me an email, I'll work and send it to you.